Evening, one and all. Good to see you all here this evening. We got a warning that we're going to get down maybe as low as 21 degrees here tonight, so you all want to hunker down when you get home. Going to be a cold one, get those pipes covered and all the rest of that. But probably you and I are not living in the opulent splendor that ancient Egypt enjoyed for centuries upon centuries. Dynasties of the Egyptian pharaohs and their immense wealth and tremendous power, of course, is awesome, to say the least. And for 430 years, the Jews, of course, also shared that land. And living in that land over the course of those four centuries would have seen structures such as the pyramids, such as other monuments, like the one, I've never shown you a picture of this before, but this is one of two temples down at the very southern border, of Egypt with Sudan. And so it sits on the edge of a lake right there. As we go through just a couple of pictures, just remember this beard right here. Okay, and then as you look at a daylight picture of Abu Simbel, which is this temple, and then same size rock immediately adjacent to it that is the second temple, which I'm not going to be showing you. Just note that these people here are really tiny next to all of this. This beard is about exactly the same size as that man, roughly about 6 feet just on the beard. And so we're looking at a land which during the time of Joseph, which precedes Moses, and then, of course, the time of Moses as well, was just phenomenally powerful, wealthy, influential, very well-developed culture and society, to say the least. Now, as we bring ourselves into the life of Joseph, which we've been studying for several weeks right now, bear in mind that all of the Egyptian chronology is very difficult to really nail down in and of itself, you know, separate from the biblically related issues. It is equally difficult to place various individuals, you know, in time frames in the biblical chronology as it relates to the Egyptian chronology. These are issues that great scholars have been unable to resolve, so I'm not going to try to attempt that tonight. But I thought I might just show you this one statue here. This would be a life-size statue that is at least one of the contenders for the pharaoh that Joseph would have been interacting with. This statue here may actually be the man that was so closely related, appreciated so much, Joseph, in his later youth, and then, of course, throughout the rest of his life. Now, a week ago, we were thinking about the early life of Joseph. Remember that he's only 17 years old when he's sold into slavery. He's 30 when he's freed from prison. And so he spent 13 years as either a slave or a prisoner. And in that 13-year period, at least two of them were spent in prison. So last week, we were thinking about how tough his life had been. And we thought about, or in terms of, despair and what a great temptation and powerful hindrance that it is, which Satan throws at very many people. They have difficult times in their lives, and Satan then is whispering ever in their ear, you should give up, you should not trust your God, you should be, you know, depressed and discouraged and therefore not involved in the Lord's work or anybody else's for that matter. Of course, Joseph never succumbed to these things. But what makes the 13 chapters in Genesis that are devoted to this man, out of 50 chapters, 13 revolve around the life of this man. What makes him so endlessly fascinating is partly his character in the midst of circumstances like these, but also the fact that those weren't the only circumstances he experienced. Joseph had started off as his father's favorite son. He had been blessed by God as a prophet with dreams and, you know, visions that God revealed to him that would involve his family. On more than one occasion, he had these visions. He was the head of Potiphar's house, even though he was a slave. He was the overseer of the whole prison, even though he was a prisoner. And ultimately, of course, he becomes second over all of Egypt. So here's this young man, very young man, who has everything life can offer. He's really young. Dad really likes him, go to many colors and all that. And then he loses everything, and he spends years in torment and trouble. And the next thing you know, he's vastly wealthier and more powerful than anything his father or his family could have ever dreamed. And if you've ever studied history at all, brethren, or if you watch even our contemporary history as it's unfolding right now, you will find that there's an endless cycle and something that is just, you know, natural to human beings. Very frequently, the people who are most oppressed at some time in their life, when the circumstances are reversed and now they come into some sort of power, what do they become? They become the worst of oppressors. It's a natural human response that when you are held down, when you suffer, when you're deprived, when things are really bad, and you can point the finger at individuals that have done this to you, and when you know that it's unfair, you know that you're undeserving of this treatment, you know that you're doing the best you can, you haven't done anything, you know, to provoke this kind of response in these people's lives, then when you see that you're on top now, then what? See, I want payback. That desire for vengeance, which belongs only to God and not to us, becomes profoundly tempting. So the lesson today is going to revolve around the character of young Joseph, who has been through these circumstances and has second command over the immense wealth and power, just one location of which we were looking at moments ago, would have been a sore temptation. Would it have not been for this man? And when his family comes begging for food, you know, and he recognizes them and they not him, oh, the temptation that it must have been for him to just wreak havoc on those people. Now, let's think about the astonishingly wise way in which he responded. First, by looking, though, in Genesis chapter 41, and I know I squeezed an aisle in a small type, so if you'll open your Bibles, please, and follow along there. It's Genesis 41, verses 39 through 46. Here now, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has informed you of all this," Joseph has interpreted Pharaoh's dream, "there is no one so discerning and wise as you are." Now, before you read any farther, if you get called in, you know, the Pharaoh, king of over all of Egypt, he says, "There isn't anybody as discerning and wise as you are already, brethren. What's the temptation?" Well, it's about time you noticed. You know, I mean, I waited a long while for you guys to figure that out. You know, I knew it. You didn't. That'd be pretty tempting. And so, "You, however," Pharaoh continues, "shall be over my house. According to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you. See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand, put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in fine linen, put the gold necklace around his neck, had him ride in his second chariot, and they proclaimed before him, "Bow the knee! Bow the knee!" And again, I'm thinking, well, if this was me, it's overdue, right? That's the way things really should have been all along. But can you imagine, brethren, he's come out of prison, he's come out of slavery, he's come out of these circumstances, and now the entire land is at his disposal. He is second only to Pharaoh, and they are honoring him as wise and discerning and bow before him everywhere he goes. Pharaoh set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said, "Though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt, from slave and prisoner to total control of all of Egypt, which at this time already had the towering pyramids, already had the kinds of rock-hewn sculptures that we saw a moment ago, was already, you know, just covered in gold and silver, was the superpower of the world, and this makes Joseph number two most powerful man, effectively, on the planet at that day. Has Joseph got problems? He's got the biggest problem of his life now, doesn't he? This is not, oh boy, finally somebody figured it out. This is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle time. It's testing time now. We'll find out what Joseph's character, his personality, what his mettle really is when you are confronted with the worst of all temptations, and that is immense wealth, as Jesus would later teach in the Gospels. It has come to temptation deluxe in the life of this man. Now, brother, we want to see, though, I put the verses at the top, and I'll put each of those, you know, on the screen as we go here. But what we're about to discover about this man is that this Joseph, he had character to the bone. He had a man who understood who he was and what his place was on this earth, no matter if he's down in a pit being sold to Midianite traders or sitting in the second chariot with people proclaiming, "Bow before me." In Genesis chapter 40 and verse 8, they said to him while he was in prison and had their dreams, "We've had a dream, there's no one to interpret it." And Joseph said to them, did he say to them, "Tell it to me"? Well, you see, yeah, he did, but I skipped the first part. He said, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please." He has not placed himself up as great and high and mighty. He has placed him beneath his God in a place of humble service. And he says, look, if you tell it to me, God will give you an answer. It isn't going to be in me. Chapter 41 and verse 16, Joseph answered Pharaoh under very similar circumstances, saying, it's not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Chapter 48, verses 8 and 9, Joseph said to his father, these are my sons. Remember, Jacob now has come to Egypt. These are my sons whom God has given to me. Chapter 15, verse 20, Genesis virtually ends with this thought. You meant evil against me, Joseph now tells his brothers, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. Now, brethren, right there in those verses, chapter 40, verse 8, 41, 16, 48, 8, and 9, and chapter 50, and verse 20, what do you find out about Joseph? Who was always on Joseph's mind? No matter if he's in the pit or he's on the throne, who is it that's in Joseph's mind? Who is in charge of Joseph's life? Does he despair and think about suicide when things are going bad? No. He goes to work, everything that comes to hand, like Solomon would later teach, he does with all of his might. He behaves as the most excellent slave there ever was, the most excellent prisoner that there ever was, because Joseph understands there's a God in heaven in charge of all things. And even though he must have thought, I myself don't deserve this treatment. I didn't do anything to my brothers worthy of that. Though he had brought the bad report back. I didn't deserve to be falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. I didn't deserve to be abandoned, by the way, after I rightly interpreted the dream, said, remember me, and then the guy forgot about him for two more years. Yeah, I didn't deserve any of these things. But through it all, particularly in this last verse, you learn this man had his feet under him. This man had perfect balance. This young man from 17, when he is sold into slavery, to 30, when as a very young man, you would be especially, I think, tempted by such power, by such wealth, by such honor and glory. If, again, we've learned anything, not from history this time in general, but from people who become stars in the entertainment world. How do most of them end up? It's most of them. Most of them end up messed up. It's just total destruction and devastation to their lives. To receive this adulation, how great thou art, you know, because of this movie, that movie, or another. Every time I hear the name or see a commercial or something, there's some new child actor or actress who's really got their chops, you know, and they're going to be the next big star. I've done this for decades, I guess. I think, poor kid. Because what's likely coming for them? Drug addiction, alcoholism, you know, all of the tickets, jail time, suicide likely. All this may be what lies ahead. Pardon me. It just breaks my heart. I love those Harry Potter books. Those movies came out and I looked at those kids and I thought, oh no. And then, sure enough, they grew up. And what do you read about them and hear about them now? Some of this stuff is some of the ugliest stuff, you know, you can possibly imagine. Is this what happened to Joseph, who got far more adulation, far more money, far more power than any star that America's ever seen on the silver screen? He does not behave this way. Because he's got his bearings. Because he's got a foundation built under him. Because at the ripe old age of 17, he had apparently learned enough from some source that we're about to consider. He had apparently learned enough that at the age of 17, he could be thrown into the fires of abuse and keep his feet under him. And then 13 years later, he could face far worse on a throne in the kingdom of Egypt and keep his balance, understand who he was. God interprets dreams. God will give you an answer. God gave me my sons. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. In the life of this man, what is above all else is the presence of God in his life. Favorite son, pit sold to the Midianites, lied about in slavery, forgotten about in prison, second in command in Egypt. Has anything changed for Joseph? Effectively, brethren, nothing's changed for Joseph. Because Joseph had his act together. Whatever circumstances I find myself in, God knows. God is in control. God is working his plan. I may not understand it. It may seem to me just as upside down and backwards as anything can get. But when you read what Joseph thinks and what Joseph says, God is in charge of my life. And I will do the best I can in whatever circumstances I find myself. I'm going to close this evening, brethren, by just looking line by line at a few verses more than what was the scripture reading this evening. There's a tremendously important little passage of scripture, Proverbs 6, verses 16 through 23. This is a sort of a style you'll find on occasion where God will name, you know, 6 and then 7, sort of a standard format there, if you will. But in this case, he's going to give a list of abominations. Now, this, of course, Solomon writing the book of Proverbs. He's the wisest man who ever lived. He's king over Egypt. He's king over Israel. You know, himself, he too is immensely wealthy and powerful. And he's going to live a long time after Joseph. Long, long time after Joseph. But if you would like to turn, I will put this up on the screen as well. I want to start reading in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16, which, again, you heard just a little while ago. There are six things which the Lord hates. Now, brethren, there's a lot of things that God doesn't like. There's an awful long list of sins. I've never tried to count how many things God declares to be sin in the Old and the New Testaments. But there are six things that really rise to the top. There are six that are somehow singular and distinct. There are six that not only does this passage say God hates, then it adds, yea, seven, which are an abomination to him. An abomination is a really big deal. That's not only a long word, that's a big word. That is a word that, you know, it tries to portray all that that God not only hates, but which is inherently just superbly ugly, despicable, horrifying, filthy, corrupt. Abomination is the word for the epitome of that which revolts God and ought to revolt us as well. So in this list now of seven things that God hates and declares to be abominations, I'm going to find out something about the mind of God, the way we find out about the way and mind of Joseph. What is number one in the list? Haughty eyes. What is it to be haughty? It means arrogant, puffed up, conceited. Think you're so great. Haughty eyes are those kind of condescending eyes, you know, looking down their nose at everybody else. You're so much less than I am, but I'm so much better than you are. Now, by the way, this is purely coincidental. As you know, I was asked by the elders to look at the book that Don Bassett had written. It's called The Joseph Code. And each week I've been looking lesson by lesson at what Don had said, plagiarizing it and stealing, you know, all the sauce here, but trying to digest it and add some material here and there, but bringing, you know, to you his ideas. And Don, you know, suggested this passage alongside the life of Joseph. But it's coincidental, brethren, that we've been talking now for several weeks in our morning class for the Corinthians about what? About arrogance. About conceit. These kinds of completely unintended on my part coincidences, providences, where classes come together like that. I can't help but think, perhaps a little bit like Joseph, you know, there's a God in heaven, and will you just look at that? So here we came. I didn't anticipate this lesson in the Joseph Code. We've just been going chapter by chapter in 1 Corinthians, but now Old Testament and ancient antiquity and Genesis to the New Testament and the Corinthian congregation. What is it that will really cause problems? Arrogance. Conceit. Thinking too highly of yourself. Now, brethren, we have to be so careful. Really do. And it's hard. It really is hard. As members of churches of Christ, I've spent 40 years looking through religions to see if I could find anybody that's closer to the pattern of the New Testament. I never have. Who are the people that have studied their Bibles the best, at least in my experience? I think you're here because it's your experience too. The members of churches of Christ who know their Bibles the best and try to apply it in their lives. I met an awful lot of people claiming to be Christians that were just detestable. Just amazing to me how they think, you know, they're Christians. Brethren, this morning, can you believe it? Came over here this morning at 7 o'clock. And found a homeless guy sleeping on our porch. Same old thing. Neighbors have complained about it time and time again. We called the police, registered, you know, with them so that we could give their special phone number to the neighbors. We told all the neighbors, look, you know, we know it scares you, it upsets you. We don't like it either. We don't want drug addicts and alcoholics camping on our property. You know, if you see one ever, and that corner right over there, you know, is their favorite location, you know, please call. Well, it's freezing cold, snow on the ground, all that. You know, nobody's out looking around, and so nobody had called. I show up at 7 o'clock. Here's this guy sleeping on the porch. So, really, very kindly, but firmly, I just said, please, you got to get up. You have to leave. Don't do this again. So the guy got up and began telling me what a lousy Christian I was, how I didn't know anything about the gospel. And here he was, he said, communing with God. Now, of course, he was fast asleep. But now he wants me to believe he's communing with God and I interrupted it. Who do I think I am to tell him this? Amazing. Amazing. So, what am I thinking that I really shouldn't have been thinking?
I'm thinking, yeah, I should aspire to your greatness. That's what I need to do. I need to just humbly bow and listen to your sermon about what Christianity is all about. Okay? Because what do I know I am? I'm better than he is. On every level, aren't I? It's pretty easy, isn't it? Yeah, does he know anything about his Bible? Nothing. Has he succeeded in life? Not at all. And he's given me a riot act on how I don't understand my Bible, which I've spent my life studying and preaching. And brother, what's going on right there? My temptation to this, isn't it? Isn't it? Okay, I don't understand the guy's life and all the rest of that. I really don't. We're not going to let them camp. We found needles out there. We've got problems. They're serious. We cannot allow, for safety reasons, our children to be running around out here with these guys leaving their needles behind. They've got to leave. But how careful we need to be. Because among all the churches and in all the world, who are we? We are the people of God. And therein lies the temptation, doesn't it, as well? To be arrogant, just like what's going on throughout your Gospels, and we talked about it this morning in the very Sermon on the Mount, just like those Pharisees who got all puffed up and arrogant, thinking they were so much better than everybody. Well, true enough, in many respects, they were. But what God hates as an abomination before Him is when you think you're so much better than everybody else. Because as we saw in the Corinthian letter this morning, there's you, there's Christ, there's God, and then there's what? There will be no arrogance at the judgment. There will be none of us in the presence of God thinking how much better we are than anybody else. So, providentially, the two lessons came together here today. But if ever there was a humble man who never had these haughty eyes, it was Joseph. It was Joseph at every stage of his life. And when the circumstances changed and his brothers came begging, what did Joseph do? He forgave them. He counseled them that they had nothing to fear. And he told them, in that preceding slide's last passage, Genesis 50 and verse 20, I know how you meant it. You meant it for evil. But his point is, it's all good. Because God meant it for good. He is more powerful than your way of going about things. And I'm here in this position to save your lives. I do it without a sense of anger or vengeance or arrogance. I do it out of pure love for you, my family, who he weeps over and embraces and welcomes into the country with his dad and the brother he's never seen, the little brother Benjamin, and all is well. He'll go to his grave in joy because he was not that. He was not an arrogant man. God hates, and it's an abomination to be arrogant, to have a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers. Now we're not here to, you know, preach all of these. Obviously there's like seven sermons right there. But brethren, there it is. This is the top of the heap for what God really dislikes. And if we would be Joseph-like, we would take that to heart. We would not allow arrogance of any kind or type into our lives. We would tell the truth, nothing but the truth. So help me God. We do not shed innocent blood, and I'm sure we wouldn't. But a heart that devises wicked plans, we'd be tempted to think about those kinds of things. Feet that run rapidly to evil, well, few of us, you know, would be like that, but it happens. The false witness who utters lies, though, can be pretty sorely tempting on occasion. And spreading strife among brothers is something the church has been plagued with since Corinth. We had strife among brothers. So some of these things seem outlandishly impossible. Other ones, brethren, are daily trials and temptations. And Joseph had conquered every last one of them. He was just a humble man who told the truth, who never retaliated
didn't devise any wicked plans, didn't run to evil, and certainly never killed anybody. He never, you know, told a lie to begin with or did it under oath in a court of law there at verse 19. And the last thing he would do is spread strife of any kind among his brethren. But in verse 20, brethren, I think now we're going to get in the next few verses and tell us why. So Proverbs, next thing says, and I believe it's directly related, contrary to these seven things God hates. Solomon then says, my son, observe the commandment of your father and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Joseph somehow, torn from his parents at the age of 17, had learned, I think, what Solomon's going to put his finger on right here. He loved his daddy. He'd been favored by his daddy. He loved his mom. But he had learned at their feet and was ready at 17 for the worst trials that we can imagine. Solomon will continue in verse 21, bind them, that is the commandment and teaching of your mother and father, bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they'll guide you. When you sleep, they'll watch over you. When you awake, they'll talk to you. For the commandment is a lamp, teaching is light, and reproofs for discipline. Now, obviously, brother, we're talking about your father and your mother. They're teaching you, but they're also reproving you. They're disciplining you. They are the way of life. They are the way of life. So, brother, as we pointed out this morning's sermon, you can't force anybody to become a Christian. You can't force your children to be faithful saints. You can't force, you know, any of these things. But you can learn everything there is to know it, God's revealed of His mind in your Old and New Testaments. These commandments and these teachings, you can learn from a very young age. And that's why we have children's classes here on Sunday mornings and Wednesday nights. And reproofs for discipline. You can learn like Joseph did, how to respond with love and appreciation when you're being corrected for some mistake that you've made. In the end, brethren, what would be, I guess, one of, at least, the overriding qualities in the life of Joseph? He was a humble man. He learned how to learn. And he learned to respect his God no matter what circumstances he found himself in. And if ever anybody had seen the furthest extremes and everything in between, it's young Joseph by the time he was 30. The brethren, he wasn't haughty about it. He wasn't vindictive about it. What was he? He was just the perfect young man who had learned, apparently from his parents, of Solomon's testimony here, you know, is an indicator, had learned about his God, about his place in this world. Second in command of Egypt is still lowliest of slaves before God. Joseph got it, and so must we. So let us remember, in all things, you should strive to be perfect. You should strive to be the living representation of Jesus Christ Himself on the earth. You should strive, brethren, to judge yourself properly. You should strive to know that you're succeeding, that you are doing a good job. You're trying to be perfect in the eyes of your God. But to be perfect, you must also never become conceited, never haughty, never arrogant. It was destroying the whole Corinthian congregation. Just recognize, you want to be the smartest, wisest, most knowledgeable saint the world's ever seen without any sin whatsoever in your life. And then not be the Pharisee who's so self-aware of it. Be the humble servant. God did this. God gave me this. I wouldn't be this but without my God. And my role in this life is to be of service to anybody and everybody else, to help and not to hinder. This is our task of this life. So we can help you, of course, in any regard, with regard to that, for their Bible studies and prayer, in anything. And certainly always we stand ready as we know how to help answer your questions, that you too might become a Christian. Be a really good one. serve God as well as Joseph did, brethren, so we can all be together in an eternal heaven. He is able to deliver us. We certainly see that in Joseph's life. If you'll stand at this time while we sing.